This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
That's why these people want to kill me. I don't know, 2-3 times a year. We have to live behind high walls with electric fences and vicious dogs on the inside. And then if they do climb over the wall, obviously, you know, I have to shoot them.
That was Paul O'Sullivan, one of South Africa's top crime fighters, on the dangers of fighting corruption. Details coming up. Also, Zimbabwe's education system is hampered again because of COVID-19. And despite the continued presence of Boko Haram, economic activity has gradually resumed along the border between Cameroon and Nigeria. All these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Major South African cities are facing the threat of land invasion as people become more desperate to get free houses due to COVID-19 economic challenges. Use of tear gas and stun grenades by police in Cape Town, Johannesburg and Pretoria has become more frequent to prevent angry crowds of people who decide to occupy any vacant land in sight. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The hunger for land is growing and South African cities are not coping. Police have had their hands full in recent months as citizens demand a piece of land. The invaders are people largely staying in informal settlements around the cities and those who can no longer afford to pay rent. In the coastal city of Cape Town alone, 1,025 incidents of land invasions were recorded since March last year. Authorities say these invasions have cost the city over $8 million. In Rubberidge, a township south of Johannesburg, hundreds of people decided to erect tin houses on vacant land. They argue that the land belongs to the government and is their right to occupy it and build houses they so desperately need. But the government says it is private land. Sizwe Shange is one of the residents who have inverted the piece of land in Rubberidge.
We're fighting for this land. This land has been here for 40 years and it hasn't been barricaded. And you can't claim and say that the land belongs to me if you don't say no trespassers. And it should be barricaded to show that it is belongs to someone else.
Police have to use rubber bullets and stun grenades to get the people off the land. However, in retaliation, they are constantly barricading roads with stones and burning tires, vowing to occupy the land at whatever cost. Land cartels are also taking advantage of the desperation for houses and making nice profits in the process. In the area of Vlaagfontein, also in Johannesburg, a land baron has grabbed private land earmarked for a $1 million housing project and started selling it to desperate house seekers. The landowner, who did not want his identity revealed, says shacks and brick and mortar houses have been erected, leaving them clueless on what to do.
There's a gentleman selling our properties out to people and claiming the land belongs to him, threatening us that they'll burn us down if we interfere and we will never get a land and land belongs to him. And we're getting no help from the government or the police force in Didier even to get rid of the guy.
The capital, Pretoria, has not been spared. Up to 300 people have invaded vacant land east of the city and erected informal structures. A Thekwini municipality spokesperson, Msawake Maisela, says the tourist-preferred city of Durban has not been spared.
There are instances whereby land is invaded in areas that are not suitable for human settlements. When the disaster strike, we are expected as the city to come to the rescue of the people that have invaded land.
But Nomsa Sizani, from Abahlali Bemjondolo, an organization fighting for those living in informal settlements in cities to be given land to build proper houses, says access to land cannot be limited to those who can afford to buy it.
People should occupy the places. They should not be evicted.
It's now over 25 years since South Africa ended apartheid, but a vast percent of its land remains in the hands of the minority whites. attempts to redistribute it has been met with legal interdicts. A bill to expropriate land without compensation is now in parliament. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
One of South Africa's top crime fighters says if President Cyril Ramaphosa sticks to his word and launches an all-out war against corruption, almost all of his government's colleagues will be jailed. Private forensic investigator Paul O'Sullivan is a legend of law enforcement in democratic South Africa. His work has led to the downfall of organized crime bosses, corrupt police commissioners, and many more. Darren Taylor reports.
O'Sullivan's on so many criminals' hit lists. He says he's been shot 3 times, and he killed one of the attackers. He doesn't want bodyguards, saying he doesn't like others doing his dirty work. O'Sullivan says he won't stop uncovering corruption until those pillaging South Africa are behind bars.
That's why these people want to kill me. I don't know, 2-3 times a year. We have to live behind high walls with electric fences and vicious dogs on the inside. And then if they do climb over the wall, obviously, you know, I have to shoot them. But the bottom line is we have to...
He's been dodging death ever since he began investigating financial crimes as a policeman in the mid-1990s. These days, he says, the police, instead of helping him, often seem bent on disrupting his investigations, especially when he's intent on charging senior members of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, with crimes.
We got a case recently where one of my staff went into a police station to open a docket, and the cop behind the counter told my staff member, oh, but you've typed out the affidavit. No, that's not allowed. It must be handwritten. And she's a lawyer. And she said, no, I'm sorry, but with all due respect, you are wrong. And he wouldn't have any of it. He said, well, I'm not allowing you to open that docket.
The police animosity towards O'Sullivan is perhaps understandable, since his works led to the imprisonment of more than a few top cops, including former police commissioner Jackie Selebi.
When I was investigating Jackie Selebi back in 2003, everybody said I was bombing. I said, no, the chief of police is corrupt. They said, oh, you're talking rubbish. I said, no, I'm telling you. With skills that I picked up many years ago when I was working for the British government, I infiltrated the crime syndicate around Jackie Selebi.
He says the way Selebi established a criminal organization within the police is still happening today in certain government departments.
He was promoting people that had absolutely no skills whatsoever, but they were getting promoted because they were loyal to him. Somebody's a sergeant one day and a captain or a major or a colonel the next day or brigadier.
O'Sullivan says to begin a successful probe into graft in a government office is simple. Establish how fast certain people close to the boss have climbed the ladder. Then target one or two who may protect themselves by spilling the beans on their corrupt overlord. O'Sullivan says he believes Ramaphosa when the president says he wants to stop corruption, but the investigator is equally convinced the ANC's beyond redemption. The ruling party says O'Sullivan's a blowhard, an attention seeker, and unpatriotic. O'Sullivan responds that it's very interesting that he doesn't call him a liar. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Education has taken another hit from COVID-19 in Zimbabwe, with the government postponing critical examinations scheduled for June, saying students haven't had enough chance to prepare. Reporter Kunzai Zanawashi has the details.
Minister of Information Monica Mutswangwa explained the decision.
Cabinet considered and approved the request for the suspension of the ZIMSEC June 2021 ordinary and advanced level examinations. Cabinet was advised that the COVID-19 pandemic, which broke out in 2020, has negatively impacted on the timing and cycle of public examinations, with the 2020 grade 7s or level and A-level examinations having commenced in early December 2020 and ended early February 2021.
Obet Masarawure is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe.
Suspension of June examinations is an knee-jerk response to the crisis in the education sector. It is a sign that our government is allergic to long-term planning. Of course, there are going to be some inconveniences to those who have been preparing for the exams.
The impact of school closures already is evident. 88 schools registered a 0% pass rate for 7th graders in last year's tests. Timothy Gwaze, a guardian to two students due for exams this year, welcomed the postponement.
As you are aware, last year our kids did not learn, although there were some who were, you know, benefiting from extra lessons. Not everyone could afford to take their kids for extra lessons. So essentially, our kids were ill-prepared for the exams.
Masaraure agrees that students were not well-prepared. The country has been easing COVID-19 lockdown restrictions, and parents hope that the third wave of the coronavirus that experts have been warning about will not materialize. Masaraure says the government ought to do more and provide long-term solutions that ensure education standards are not compromised. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunamashe from Harare.
Muslims around the world mark the holy month of Ramadan. Some genocide survivors in Rwanda are taking the opportunity to thank the religion for its efforts to shelter Tutsis during the 1994 genocide. Many Rwandans have converted to Islam after seeing how innocent Tutsis were killed in churches by Christians, including priests and nuns. Eugene Iwimana has the details from Rwanda's capital, Kigali.
Ramadan began on Monday, which also was the last day of the official week of commemoration of the genocide, when armed militias slaughtered over 800,000 Tutsis. Survivors like Joven Irora say Muslims treated them differently than Christians. The behavior of many Muslims changed our perception of Islam. He says he saw many Muslims hiding Tutsis in their homes or in mosques. He says he has never heard of a Tutsi who was killed in a mosque. He says today, as our brothers start Ramadan, is the right time to thank them. During the genocide, many went to churches seeking sanctuary. But the Commission for the Fight Against Genocide says thousands were killed in churches around the country. More than 2,000 people were killed in the help of Pastor Wenceslas Munyeshaka. 27 years later, many churches have become memorial sites. The Yamata Church in Eastern Rwanda is now a mass grave for over 50,000 people. Entering the former church now, you see caskets in the victims' clothes piled on pews before you first see the image of Virgin Mary. This has led to many Rwandans converting to Islam. Suleimani Matabalo was a pastor before the genocide. Now he is Ali Hajj. He says, I saw with my own eyes how Muslims were trying hard to hide Tutsis, while my fellow Christians were persecuting them. And I said, this is the right religion. He says, God opened his heart and he is proud to be Muslim. And he says, he will do everything to help many Rwandans convert as well. He says reading the Quran helps young people grow with good manners and intention of avoiding discrimination, because he says Islam is about love. In his Monday's message, the Mufti of Rwanda, Sheikh Salim Hitimana, urged Muslims to fight another battle, stopping genocide ideology. He says, this whole month comes as we are remembering Tutsis killed in the genocide. We have to comfort the survivors and fight genocide ideology and deniers who frequently spread their hatred message on social media. The Rwandan Muslim community says Muslims made up 1% of Rwandan population before the genocide, but now comprise more than 15%. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Officials in Cameroon and Nigeria say economic activity has gradually resumed along their border despite the continued presence of the terrorist group Boko Haram. Markets have reopened and border merchants say traveling near the border is safer thanks to a heavy presence of troops. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Amechidi, Cameroon.
40-year-old gasoline seller Omaru Fuman says life is gradually returning to the town of Amchide on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. He says many merchants have been crossing into Cameroon from Nigeria with electronic appliances, auto parts and food to sell. Fuman says he is one of 8 men who have resumed buying gasoline from Nigeria and selling it in Cameroon. He says before he crosses over from Cameroon, he calls his suppliers in the Nigerian town of Banki to find out if it is safe to travel. Sieni Lamin Buka is the traditional ruler and mayor of Kolofata, a Cameroonian town on the border with Nigeria. Buka and 5 of his family members were abducted by Boko Haram fighters in 2014 and released after a week. Buka says business is picking up in Kolofata and cattle ranchers from African countries have begun visiting the cattle market. He notes there is still a security problem. On April 7, Boko Haram fighters attacked merchants in Kolofata for food and money, just 5 days after the cattle market reopened.
The first thing to do is to help us to finalize the security actions and also to boost the commercial activities. Amchide is a strong commercial city. We have people come from the Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and so on.
Rights groups are also concerned about the safety of civilians on the Cameroon-Nigeria border. Ilaria Alegroze is senior Central African researcher for Human Rights Watch. She says there has been a resurgence of Boko Haram atrocities in the region with serious consequences for civilians.
The security situation in this region remains extremely volatile and violence continues to push people out of their homes. We as Human Rights Watch, but also UN agencies, have documented how hundreds of families across the region move daily to safer areas to avoid Boko Haram attacks. For example, following the January 8 Boko Haram attack in Mosogo, hundreds of people did not spend the night at home for over a month.
Alegrozi says conditions in Cameroon Northern Administrative Units like Mayo Sava, Mayo Chanaga and Mayo Moskuta do not appear conducive for displaced people to safely return to their homes.
More needs to be done to effectively protect civilians in the far north region, including by boosting the military presence and patrols, and also ensuring that the soldiers uphold human rights standards.
Boko Haram has been fighting for 11 years to create an Islamic caliphate in northeast Nigeria. The fighting has spread to Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Benin. The United Nations reports that Boko Haram violence has cost the lives of at least 30,000 people and displaced about 2 million in Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Amchide, Northern Cameroon.
Although Africa is famous for its iconic wildlife, it is also home to many endangered species such as the mountain gorilla, Grevy's zebra, the Ethiopian wolf, and the pangolin. Protecting them while establishing sustainable relationships with their human neighbors will be key to the continent's future. But some conservationists are increasingly insistent that to get their fellow Africans motivated to help, they must be led by experts and policymakers who have African sensibilities and points of view. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Kudusiwe Shibunyu, CEO of the African Wildlife Foundation, the largest African-led international conservation organization. Shibunyu began by criticizing the outsized influence Europeans and American NGOs have on how wildlife is cherished and conserved.
We cannot afford to continue having conservation on the continent led by foreigners. Majority of NGOs and efforts to conserve wildlife is led by foreigners. The few Africans are white Africans. We need black Africans that support conservation on the continent to grow our constituency.
I know with the African Wildlife Foundation, you've had a lot of experience with this.
Absolutely. I've met so many African leaders who, in the first few minutes, think that I have a foreign agenda because I'm talking about conservation.
Where is that view coming from?
The fact that Africans have only heard from foreigners telling them why conservation is important. We need to hear Africans telling Africans. Remember, Africa has been managing wildlife and consuming wildlife for centuries. But once it starts becoming a business, that you are going to kill a pangolin from a village, transport it 200 miles away, put it on a plane and export it. Already through that value chain, you've lost the experience and the local knowledge of how do you handle a pangolin and what's your relationship to it.
You've been telling me that until recently, most Africans have had an emotional or even a spiritual connection to animals, particular animals too, depending on where they're from.
Absolutely. I belong to a black and white Columbus monkey. That is my name. That is my clan. That's who I am. I do anything in my power to protect a black and white monkey. All Africans are like me. And what we are losing is that connection. That is going to only come when Africans discuss conservation with Africans.
What is the Western, or shall we say, imported view of conservation?
Conservation of the continent is entirely based on science. And the history of conservation is not very good on the continent. I worked in Latin America. There, it's mostly about indigenous people and their rights to land. And in Africa, it's about protecting wildlife from people, which has translated into wildlife is owned by everybody and nobody. It's a public good. And we cannot continue to accept that Africans living next to national parks value a chicken more than a leopard or a rhino.
Why do they place that sort of lesser value on wildlife?
Why? If you have a goat, you can marry. If you have two pigs, you can buy land. But you cannot pay medical bills because you live next to a rhino. The rhino definitely has more value than a chicken. But how do you get Africans to value a rhino more than a chicken? What we need to do is to put that value in front of Africans because they need to see that direct benefit. And it's possible in the areas where we work, we have managed to do that with private landowners and communal landowners.
How does that work?
It is very simple. People who come to see these rhinos, they pay $2,000, $3,000 a day. How many chickens are those? In Rwanda, we built a lodge with the communities. This is one of the highest end lodge in Rwanda. Communities earn more than $500,000 annually from their lodge. To break it down for you, communities partner with a private operator that is paid a fee. The community, they earn the revenue and they've been able to sustain their families. In Botswana, one tour company hires more women than any other rural company outside agriculture.
So zooming out a bit, what's your message, big picture?
It's how we design tourism. It's how we design ownership. It's how we design relationships. What we are struggling with now is how do you scale it up to the level that actually supports more Africans and supports the national economies. But it's possible.
That was Kudu Sibwe Shibunyu, president and CEO of the African Wildlife Foundation, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.